Reproductive justice advocates say quality sexuality education is missing from public schools. Quality means making sex education comprehensive by including ways to prevent sexually transmitted infections and offering a holistic and positive view of sexuality without religious viewpoints. But 29 states plus Puerto Rico are still receiving federal funding for abstinence-only education. And medically inaccurate and biased information is being given out in the classroom. That's according to the guests we have in the studio today. With us, we have Phillida Burlingame, the Sex Education Policy Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. Thank you for being here, Phillida.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have LaRonda Crosby-Johnson with the Bay Area Communities for Health Education.
Hi.
And Gabriela Valle, the Director of Community Education and Mobilization for California Latinas for Reproductive Justice. She's on the line with us from Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
So, Phillida, you said that you want comprehensive sex education in schools. What does that look like?
Well, it looks like young people being given the information that they need and deserve in order to be able to make really informed, healthy choices about their sexuality, their sexual choices and behaviors. Unfortunately, what they often receive now doesn't give them what they need in order to make healthy choices for themselves.
What does the education they're receiving now look like?
Often it can be abstinence only, which means that what they're being told is that unless they are abstinent until they get married, they are likely to suffer from a whole range of mental, emotional, and physical negative outcomes. So it's really kind of a social messaging that's wrapped up in the guise of health education. And what young people really need are the healthy messages that will help them to lead the healthy lives that they want to lead, and not be telling them that being sexually active before they're married will automatically lead to negative outcomes, because that's just not true.
That's Phillida Burlingame. She's a sex education policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. Gabriela Valle, you work with Latino families and young people as well as school districts. Can you talk to us a little bit about your experience around sexual health education, what you've seen?
What I wanted to add from our work with Latino communities is the inclusion of parents, and that CLRJ really supports family communications. One of the things that we do is offer trainings that actually help parents get involved in dialogue around issues of sex and sexuality with their children. We often, during this workshop, let Latino parents know that, you know, in a survey, when Latino parents were asked if they would support comprehensive sex ed, after being explained what the elements were of comprehensive sex ed, that it had to be unbiased, that it should be culturally and linguistically relevant and age appropriate, and that it should include discussion of not just abstinence, but also prevention. And when this type of dialogue is able to happen with parents surveyed from the Public Health Institute, they found that 90% of Latino parents actually would support comprehensive sex ed. And we really lead with this because it is a way of really sort of challenging the idea that's out there that Latino parents wouldn't support sexual health education.
That was Gabriela Valle with California Latinas for Reproductive Justice. We're about to listen to a clip produced by Charlie Stewart and rhrealitycheck.org. In this clip, we'll hear students in Savannah, Georgia, talk to the reporter about the Choosing the Best program, a sex education curriculum they are receiving in public high schools. Let's hear this clip.
For more than a dozen years, the state of Georgia has taught a program called Choosing the Best in its public schools, an abstinence from sex before marriage curriculum that teaches that condoms don't work.
Abstinence Plus, I don't even think Abstinence Plus mentions contraception methods at all. It's like, don't have sex, sex is bad, you don't have sex before you're married. Even when you're married, you only have certain types of sex. It's just ridiculous.
Abstinence Plus supposedly mentions contraception. And
but
then
it only to the negative. It actually does, but it's only negative. It's like condoms do not work at all. Birth control will kill you. Mm-hmm. Do not touch this stuff at all. Don't have sex until you're married, because that will be the only thing that will protect you.
I would say sex education in Chatham County shouldn't be called sex education. It should be called a religion class or something, because it includes so much stuff on morals and values of a specific religion that not everybody follows. But if you want to be in that class, you have to go by, like, you'll die if you have sex, or having sex before marriage is bad.
Okay, that was just a clip produced by Charlie Stewart and rhrealitycheck.org. You can go to that website and see more clips on sexuality education across the nation. So we just heard students from Savannah, Georgia, talking to us about what their sexual health curriculum looks like. What do you two think? You two have been working in the classroom and working with school districts across the state for quite a while now. How does that compare to what you have seen?
I believe, you know, what they are saying about the instruction of the Choosing the Best program is absolutely accurate in terms of these abstinence only until marriage programs. When they do mention condoms and contraception, it's only in order to try to convince students that they are ineffective, that they shouldn't use them. That often these programs say that HIV can pass through a latex condom, which it cannot. And, you know, the goal is to dissuade young people from taking advantage of these, you know, important methods of preventing unintended pregnancy, STIs, et cetera. And it's really a scandal that these programs are being presented to young people and being still funded with federal dollars.
Philetta Burlingham, you work with ACLU, working with school districts across the state. Can you talk to us about any time that you've seen anything remotely like this outside of Savannah, Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, in California, we now have a good law on the books, which is very helpful. But there are still school districts in the state that are using abstinence-only until marriage curricula. And even here in the Bay Area, which many people consider kind of progressive heartland, there are still school districts. About a year ago, I worked with parents and community members in Fremont, which is in the Bay Area, using a curriculum very similar to that. And LaRonda and I are both working in Sonoma County with parents and community members to try to get rid of another federally funded abstinence-only agency that, again, says the same thing. If you're not abstinent until you get married, only negative things will happen to you, and they present misinformation about condoms and contraception. So much as we would like to say, oh, well, this is a problem of the Deep South or whatever, it's really not true. This is a pervasive issue that affects school districts across the country.
And can you give us any examples from curriculum that you've seen, perhaps in California, that also furthers this abstinence only until marriage ideology?
The clip that you just played was from Choosing the Best. And the first time that that curriculum came to my attention was when I first started working on this issue in the mid-90s. And at that time, I mean, as much as you just heard the students complaining about how extreme it was, in the mid-90s, these programs were even more extreme than they are today. And Choosing the Best, I believe it was Choosing the Best, had a little segment on how difficult it was to use condoms. And it said that there were 10 steps required to use a condom. And one of the steps was to wash the genital area with Lysol before and after condom use, which, if you just stop to think about it, that is the most grotesque, appalling thing. I mean, really horrifying. And it was actually a funny story because it was there in the curriculum. People were appalled, obviously, you know, public health people, when they saw this. And some advocates contacted Lysol and said, are you aware that this curriculum is promoting your product in this way? And ultimately, Lysol sent a cease and desist letter to the publisher saying you cannot use our product in this way. And I'm pretty sure it was Choosing the Best, which is disappointing that it's still around and, you know, it's being funded by federal dollars in Georgia today. California, as far as I know, there are no districts that I know that are using that particular program, but there are many that they all wear kind of the same clothes. A lot of them use the same lingo. They follow the same kind of marching orders, and they're relatively interchangeable.
LaRonda Crosby Johnson, you've been working not only inside the classroom, but also with parents and community members for 30 years now around sexuality education. Can you talk to me a little bit about what you've seen and perhaps how things have changed in those 30 years?
I think some of the most rewarding work for me personally has been the work with parents who come to this conversation sometimes very nervous. You know, many parents didn't receive this type of education in schools, and certainly a lot of families weren't discussing this topic. And that seems to be what drives a lot of the fear around this subject area, that it's just not something that takes place in normal conversation. You know, myself and some other health educator folks, we laugh all the time and say, you know, we get to talk about this all the time, but, you know, the person who delivers your mail probably doesn't. And so I think when you get an opportunity to work with parents and you get them to increase their comfort and understanding around the topic area, that opens up conversation with their children. So as a health educator who's been in classrooms with young people, for me, it felt almost ridiculous to just have the conversation with young people without having it with the adults who impact and influence their lives far more than I would. So I've seen those kind of coming together of those two worlds, where when young people get the information, they go home and talk to their parents about it, which is always encouraged with comprehensive, you know, sex ed. We want you talking to your parents. We want you talking to the adults that care about you the most. And parents loosen up a little bit about it. They realize they don't have to know all the answers. I think that's probably the number one concern or fear that I hear from parents. Like, if I say something about this and I don't know the answer, what do I do? And I tell them, you say, I don't know. You know, we'll find it out together. But to just have the conversation, know that the place is available for your child to talk to you about it.
That was LaRonda Crosby Johnson. She works with Bay Area Communities for Health Education. Gabriela Valle, you're the Director of Community Education and Mobilization for California Latinas for Reproductive Justice. So you do this work with parents, with community members. Can you talk to us about how you think Latina families or perhaps marginalized communities in general, if they feel effects more so when these abstinence only until marriage or medically inaccurate curriculums get put into the classroom?
Parents often, especially immigrant parents, often assume a almost too positive view of what the education is that their students are getting. So they might assume that they are getting some information about development and their body and what to expect. And then we start having conversation and they realize that's not happening. And they also assume that the information that, again, their kids are going to get will be accurate. And this assumption comes from what we're in this country now, right? So our students are coming to school in the U.S. There's a certain expectation of what curriculum might look like. And we actually spend some time talking to parents about where do those ideas come from, and does that actually reflect the reality of what their students are getting? And most of the time in most rooms, unfortunately, we all come to that conclusion, just like LaRonda was saying, that this is not what students get. And it's really unfair when you think about it from the point of view of a young person. So most young people across the U.S., and we certainly are talking about California, where, like Philetta mentioned earlier, we look really good on paper. We look as though this is a state where young people should have the right lawfully to access comprehensive sex ed, that should be what's offered in their school. But because it's not mandatory, so on one hand, young people are not getting good comprehensive sex ed, or in many cases not getting any sex ed at all. Oftentimes we'll see that administrators will find ways to get out of this or cover sex ed in 3 days somewhere in between driver's ed training and some other curriculum. Yet you look at the statistics for adolescent pregnancy in the state, and then oftentimes those numbers are really directly pointed towards Latinos, and your number for adolescent pregnancies are really high. So we didn't prepare the young person with enough information or education. We don't have a lot of programs that support parents in having this dialogue with their kids as they're interested in, but we will blame youth for STDs, STIs, for contracting HIV, for adolescent pregnancy. And so this is really what young people are up against. The clip that you played earlier, I think, just really reminds, I think it's really important for adults to hear young people speaking for themselves and really pointing out how unfair it is. They're the ones that pay the price when we as the adults are not giving them the education that they need and they deserve. And in California, they have a right to it. But we find oftentimes that administrators are operating off of their own belief system or sometimes their own misinformation. They assume that parents, whether it's Latino parents or African American parents, they're assuming, oh, well, if we do too much around sex education, the parents are going to complain. Yet they probably, in most cases, haven't even talked to parents to find out what it is that people want. So there's a lot of myth busting that we have to do across communities around these issues.
Phillida Burlingame, you've been working with the ACLU around sexuality education in schools for quite some time now. Can you talk to us about what the real consequences, whether it be health consequences or other consequences that come from primarily abstinence only until marriage curriculums or inadequate sex education curriculum?
Evaluations that have been done of abstinence only until marriage curricula show that they're ineffective in delaying the onset of sexual activity and also, not surprisingly, also ineffective in increasing the use of condoms and contraception, since that's not their goal. So they're not effective in achieving their stated outcome, but there are negative consequences in the sense that research has shown that while some young people have delayed perhaps by a small amount of time, they are less likely when they do initiate sexual activity to use contraception, to go to a clinic, for example, if they suspect that they might have an STI. There's a sense of shame, I think, of having kind of broken, you know, in particular, this research was relating to abstinence pledges, where young people will take a vow and say, I swear I will not be sexually active until I get married. And then most young people end up not being able to stick with that pledge. Over 95%, I think it is, of Americans have sex outside of marriage. And so when they have then sort of gone out of that contract, there's a sense of not then following the healthy steps to ensuring that their sexual health is being protected. The young people will become sexually active at some point in their lives, and these programs are not helping them in remaining abstinent, and they are providing them with misinformation and a sense of shame about following the healthy steps that they need to take in order to promote and protect their sexual health.
LaRonda, do you have anything to add to that?
And just thinking how, what a disadvantage we put young people at, because the time to problem solve and the time to critically think about your choices and decision is not at that moment. And so we prepare young people for almost every single thing in their life other than making healthy choices about their sexuality. We don't expect them to do anything else without some support and help and information. You know, we give them a year to learn how to drive a car. We give them a course to learn how to take an SAT test, but we give them nothing to make the decisions that are going to actually change their lives.
So just also on that point, I think one of the other things is to look at sex education in the overall context of young people's lives. And Gabriela was mentioning earlier the disadvantages that families in the Latino community face. And in particular, I think there's language access barriers. Here in California, we see in the Central Valley, which is where our rates of teen pregnancy and STIs are the highest, that's often the place where we have found the sex education to be the most inadequate. And yet young people there also suffer from a lack of access to other reproductive health services. So they can't get the information elsewhere in the community, and thus the schools need to be the place where they can reliably go get information that tells them in an accessible, realistic way what they need to know, because they don't have access to it elsewhere in their community. And that's one of the things that's really hard, is that then when the school lets down its part of the bargain in that way, young people are really left without any resources.
Gabriela, can you talk to us a little bit more about barriers that immigrant communities face to receiving quality sexual health information?
you take a group of, for example, English language learners, if we're finding that English-speaking students aren't getting either enough or adequate comprehensive sex ed, take English language learners from any cultural background, and you've now exacerbated that problem times 10. Very few schools have curriculum available to them in any other language. You layer that with the fact that Latinas in California are the most uninsured. And this is like young women from teens up into their early 20s. We represent the highest number of uninsured people in the state of California. And that net is really wide. I mean, it really includes young men and women at the age where they're going to be, because of all the reasons already stated, the most in need to access services. Phyllida mentioned the Central Valley, and this is an area that California Latinas for Reproductive Justice has been working in for a few years, like ACLU. And I wanted to say that we have, you know, a positive, a good story that we wanted to share. We've been doing some work in Visalia in the Central Valley. We took on working with a local community organization there, Act for Women and Girls. So we took on dealing with just one school district, which was the Visalia School District. We, working with ACT, we got the young women ready to go and speak to the school board to talk about the issues. With such a small group of, and they were mostly young Latina women from the community, they were able to do the research, and they were able to show the school district that with four high schools in this district, there was four different books in terms of the curriculum that they were exposed to around sex education. One of the books was incredibly outdated and actually had in it some really offensive language when it came to the issue of HIV and AIDS that still made it sound like, well, HIV and AIDS is a gay man's issue. That is completely irresponsible for that to be happening in 2009 and 2010 when we know HIV so greatly is affecting communities of color, particularly women. So our win from this comes from the young women going to the Visalia School Board and calling them on it, saying to them, can you explain to us, you are the adults, we're the students, can you explain to us why it is that we have curriculum that's old and outdated and isn't comprehensive? And California state law says we have a right to have comprehensive sex ed if we're going to have sex education covered at all. And so late last spring, early summer, the school board decided that, yes, they need to make that change, and they're in that process now. So we're really excited, continue working with ACT and working with the school district in Visalia. Now, this is one small case. This is four high schools in this one district, but it is possible, and it's especially possible when community folks are really the ones who push for this. So in this case, it was a lot of students that were involved. There were also some parents. And that was really important for the school board to see that it wasn't just the students taking it on, but there were a handful of parents that they got to see that parents are in support.
That was Gabriela Valle with California Latinas for Reproductive Justice. I'm Julieta Kuznid. You're listening to Making Contact, National Radio Project's Making Contact. So both Gabriela and LaRonda have talked about a law which is now on the books, the 2004 legislation, which was enacted stating schools in California may not use abstinence-only until marriage curriculum to teach sex education and must, if they're going to teach sex education, they have to include comprehensive sex education. Can you talk to us about the law and how this has played out?
We really like to think about it as sort of a reproductive justice or even, you know, in some respects, a civil rights law. It's got a lot of different aspects. As Gabriela was mentioning, it has a requirement that curriculum be accessible to English language learners, students with disabilities. Similarly, it has to be appropriate for students of all sexual orientations, students of all genders. It needs to include medically accurate information and provide information about all FDA-approved methods of contraception as well as about abstinence. So it's not just saying, you know, you have to cover abstinence, you have to cover contraception. It's also saying who are all the students in the classroom and how can we make sure that effective health information that's going to be free of bias is being taught to them as well as to the students sitting to the side of them. And that's a really exciting law to have on the books. As we've all been saying, the challenge comes in implementation. California has 1,000 school districts, and there's very little enforcement at the state level. The California Department of Education has been quite good on this issue. They have one staff member who works on this, which is really disappointing considering the size of the state. But she is a powerhouse and does a lot of work in this area. But it really is dependent on local action to get the law implemented. So what we have is a great tool. It's great leverage for communities to use. But as Gabriela was talking about in Visalia, what the community needs is to get involved in order to make sure that the law is actually having an effect on the sex education that their students are being taught, because it's not an automatic. It's very powerful when parents and students go to the school district and they say, this is what I want for my child. This is what the law says. And yet you're doing something else. Why is that?
LaRonda, you have been working inside the classroom and outside the classroom with parents and community members. Can you tell us about what you think is essential to include in a truly comprehensive sex education curriculum?
I think one thing that sort of worked against this whole conversation has been that it's been portrayed that there's abstinence education on one side and this word comprehensive sex education on another side. First of all, most people don't even know what that means. And one of the things that I work with Bay Area Communities for Health Education, which was a group of parents who did just what Phyllida said. They kind of got in the face of school boards and school districts and said, this is what our children deserve, to make people understand what those two elements actually are. A discussion of abstinence takes place within a comprehensive sex education program. And every time I say that in front of a group of people, they go, oh, as if, you know, I just said some incredible thing, but it's never put together that way. So they don't understand that that's going to happen in this conversation. A comprehensive sex education program is going to not only give young people medically accurate information about contraception, a discussion opportunity around abstinence as a way of preventing pregnancy, as a way of preventing STDs, but it's also giving young people an opportunity to practice skills of negotiation, problem solving skills, conflict resolution skills, decision making skills. In a really strong comprehensive sex education program, there is a discussion of values so that every young person in there is able to fit this information into the value system that works for their life. And so, you know, I encourage young people to go home and have this conversation. Find out what your grandmother thinks about it. Find out what your aunties. Yeah, they're going to get red in the face and blush, and someone may even run screaming from the room. But when they come back, ask them what kind of information they received. Tell them a little bit about what's going on in your classroom. So it opens up dialogue. And I think that because of some of the stuff that Phyllida and Gabriela both mentioned about what happens when you don't have comprehensive sex ed in the classroom, it shuts down the conversation. So you have that young person who's either already been sexually active or who may be a parent, because that's the other thing, that there's this assumption sometimes when the abstinence only until marriage folks walk in the room, that that's who they're talking to, is they're talking to abstinent teenagers. And that often is not the case. So you may be talking to a 15-year-old that already has two kids, and she's feeling totally outside of that conversation. So comprehensive sex education opens up dialogue and opens up conversation. It gives young people an opportunity to have this conversation amongst their peers. That, to me, is one of the foundations of comprehensive sex ed, is that it doesn't negate their intelligence. They're the experts on adolescence right now, because they're the only people, teenagers, at this very moment. And they know what's going on, and they really will tell you what they need if we listen.
LaRonda, so you have taken this work not just in the classroom with students, but you're actually working with parents and community members. Can you talk to us about what that feels like and looks like, since oftentimes this is such a difficult conversation to have?
It begins meeting parents where they are. And so that's both physically and emotionally. So you know, parents are busy, busy people. And as a parent, I totally get that. So we don't try to add additional meetings for them, right? So we plug into the parents are already meeting, whether that's formally in the context of some school or community organization. I encourage parents, if you've got a group of parents that just want to sit around in your kitchen together, I'll come to your kitchen. So I've had a couple of parent conversations in somebody's living room. We also want to meet them where they are sort of emotionally around this. So it helps, as Gabriella mentioned, it really builds community for the parents to be able to get together with each other and hear that I'm not the only parent who's not quite sure how to talk to my son or daughter about this topic. Or they will hear from a parent who's actually had some great success with it, and they get tips from the parents. Whenever I'm talking to parents, is not to like come in with this person with all the answers to this. I want to come in as a resource about how they can approach their school, you know, giving them information about what their school can and is required to provide for their young person. But I want to build a community of parents who have each other to rely on when I'm gone on to the next community. And schools listen to parents. Schools listen to what students have to say. And so when we can sort of mobilize them together to bring this to their school districts, that's when we really see the change happening. When you get that one parent who's sort of got that bee in her bonnet or his bonnet, who's in the, you know, superintendent's face all the time, or who's nagging the health teacher about why you only spend 6 days on human reproduction, that's when, you know, if for no other reason than to get that parent to be quiet. It's like, okay, we'll change it so that they'll go away and be quiet. But I think that one of the things that we're hearing is that this opens up a different kind of relationship between those parents and children, too. And they're kind of going for the same thing at the same time. They're listening. Kids are seeing that their parents want the best for them. And they don't often feel like that, particularly during their adolescence. And parents really get a chance to hear from their children in a way that they may not in the normal course of their relationship and activity together.
So, Gabriela Valle, you work with California Latinas for Reproductive Justice and have been working with parents and community groups for quite a while. Can you talk to us about what that experience has been like?
Sure. We offer family communications trainings, and so we put it under that umbrella because it really is a broader umbrella, right, rather than just talking about sex ed. That really is a part of it, but it really allows parents the opportunity to come together and identify what their own values are around these issues and really get comfortable with it. It allows them to have comfortable space to be uncomfortable, like a lot of what LaRonda described. We usually take the first 5 minutes and literally like allow parents to just, if they need to giggle or sort of get comfortable with being uncomfortable for the next hour, hour and a half while we have these discussions. You'll find yourself in a room of parents that when you ask them what is the number one reason they haven't spoken to their children about these issues, is usually because they're a little bit embarrassed. They don't know what to say. So an immigrant parent might share that they only went to sixth grade or so. A U.S.-born Latino parent might say, well, I'm afraid to give the wrong information, to not know, to look unprepared in front of my child. And so we really create space that's safe for parents to have this dialogue and to really figure out what is it that they want to tell their own children. And they realize, you know, by the end of the workshop, a few of them realize, you know, they may be the parent that goes home and says to their child, well, I still would prefer that you're abstinent. The difference is they're going to go home and say, this is why and how it relates to my value. And the other difference is that even if they go home and they're that parent, they've come to an understanding that it's really the right and just and fair thing for their child to have access to all of the information, to have the information they need up front, to really think about it. So I often say to parents, and I have a 16-year-old nephew, so it's true in our family as well, and it's this reminder that our children will make some of the most difficult decisions when we're not around. So it's our responsibility to equip them with the information that they need, but it's more than information, right? It really is creating safe space where dialogue can happen, where both, whether it's a parent or a young person, can really take this information and say, well, okay, so if I need to know this about protection and prevention and birth control, what does that actually mean in my life, and how would that play out? And what would it mean for me to know that information and yet to have access. Like, you can talk to a young person all you want about a condom. If when they get to the drugstore, the condoms are behind a glass case and you have to go and ask the adult to unlock them, because it's still, crazy as that sounds, it still happens every so often, then how exactly is that, is the information itself equipping the young person? It's not. So then really being able to broaden the way that we think about these issues, that example I'll share with parents, they really get it. They kind of take a step back and they're like, yeah, you're right. If my young person went to a class and they just said use condoms, and then they went to the store and this happened, and they realize that, you know, access really then becomes just as important as having the information. So a lot of our successes really come right at the end of the workshop when, in terms of dealing with parents, they've become a lot more comfortable. They've identified some tools. Some of the younger parents might identify starting a conversation around issues of sexuality with their young person over text. Now, that might, to older parents, sound kind of crazy and impersonal, but we've already identified that starting the conversation sometimes is a little bit uncomfortable. You're not sure where to start. So if that becomes a space that's comfortable for you, then all the texting is a tool. Hey, I saw this, you know, I was watching TV today, and on this show they talked about this issue. Can we talk about it at some point? The other thing we like to do is really support parents by letting them know that even though they're dealing with their teenager, and even though their assumptions are that their teenager don't want to talk to them, and yes, at some point your teen might roll their eyes or look like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you, we're going to have this conversation. The truth is, young people do want to know what their parents think. They do want to hear this. They want to know what the values are. They want to have this conversation. So we're able to, when we work with youth, remind them that the parents, you know, it's not that they don't care and they don't love you, they just maybe don't know what to say. We're also able to remind the parents, it's not that your youth don't want to hear from you, but yeah, they're, you know, guess what? You're going to share a little bit of that discomfort too. So sometimes the beginning of the conversation is like, you know, one of the moms saying to me in Spanish, I don't know how I'm going to have this conversation with her. Well, that's your opening line. You sit down with your daughter and you say, I don't know exactly how we're going to have this conversation, but let's try. And so a lot of what happens in the family communications training that CLRJ is able to do in different communities is that, create that space, bring parents together. So then now they've identified other parents with whom they can have conversations and get prepared for this and even take tips.
Gabriela Valle is the Director of Community Education and Mobilization for California Latinas for Reproductive Justice. So, Phyllida, you've worked with communities across California. Can you talk to us about a success story that you've seen around comprehensive sex education?
Well, I think one of the most compelling stories that I've seen is actually the parent who was the founder of LaRonda's organization, Bay Area Communities for Health Education. She was a mom and was not politically active exactly in her community. And she had been told that her son was going to be in an abstinence class. And she thought, okay, that sounds fine. And then they were having dinner one night and her son said to her, the wrapper from that straw looks like the seaweed they put in a woman's cervix when she has an abortion. And the mom, whose name is Renee Walker, understandably said, what are you talking about? And where did you hear that? And her son said, oh, I heard that in sex ed class. And he was in sixth grade at the time. So this is not age appropriate information. And she said, well, what else did you learn about abortion? And he said, well, that it tears the arms and legs off babies. So this mom, who up to that point was, as she describes herself, like a swim team mom in her school district, became a just furious advocate for getting this crisis pregnancy center, which is an agency whose goal is to dissuade people from having abortions and to introduce the idea that abortion is dangerous. This was who was in her son's school teaching sex ed. Her mission became to get this agency out of her district and to bring in comprehensive sex education. And she marshaled the resources that she needed to do that. She contacted me, she contacted lots of people, and she was successful. She was successful because she was a tiger in just pursuing her school district. And now amazingly enough, that school district was chosen as a model district by a foundation funding a national initiative for the implementation of comprehensive sex education. So that district is now receiving funds to implement comprehensive sex ed. And she went on to found this organization, Bay Area Communities for Health Education, whose mission it is to educate and mobilize and organize other parents to do the same thing in their districts. And it's really an effective strategy because, as we've heard throughout this discussion, parents have such a critical role to play, both with their young people and then as advocates and as spokespeople within the community. And I've seen that happen in that school district, which was Mount Diablo Unified, and then in several other districts here as well, that where parents get involved and they get mobilized, change happens. And I've seen this repeatedly, that the abstinence-only programs can be thrown out, are thrown out, and can be replaced by comprehensive sex ed.
And can you talk to us about how, if a parent is listening or someone who's just very concerned around this issue, how can they get involved in their school district?
There is an assumption on many parents that their schools are going to be teaching their students accurate, good information. I think we all come to the school system with the belief that they're going to be teaching our kids the right thing. And unfortunately, in this particular subject area, that's not always the case. So the first thing I would say is to people listening, find out what sex education is being taught in your school district. And if they say, oh, well, we're teaching abstinence plus or something like that, dig deeper, because these can often be code words for education that's not really education. It's political indoctrination, and it should not be in the classroom. So that's the first thing I would say. Find out what's being taught. And if what's being taught is medically inaccurate, if it's biased, if it's political ideology, you know, under the guise of health education, then go to the superintendent and say, even if you're not a parent, as a taxpayer in this district, this is not what we should be teaching our young people. And talk to other members of the community. Bring other parents involved. Get students involved. Get community-based organizations, you know, that have some standing in the community. And there are organizations out there, the ACLU of Northern California being one, CLRJ being one, Bay Area Communities for Health Education being another. And there are many national organizations that have the resources that parents can use. As a parent or as a community member, you have a critical role to play in finding out what's happening locally and then starting the intervention to making change.
Phillida Burlingame, you've been following this issue not just on a state level, but federally as well. Can you talk to us about how funding around sex education has changed from under Bush's administration now to Obama?
Abstinence only until marriage funding actually began during the Clinton administration. It was part of welfare reform, which is something that people do not typically know. It was introduced by the Republicans, but signed into law by Clinton. However, it ballooned significantly under the Bush administration. There was a whole new layer of funding that was added during that time. And we have now spent as a nation more than $1.5 billion on abstinence only until marriage funding. So it's a significant amount of money. And over the past decade, there has been extensive infrastructure that has been built with this funding, both national organizations and then organizations at the local level. That has changed with the Obama administration. There was about $120 million that went to a program called community-based abstinence education. That was cut by the Obama administration and instead replaced by funding for comprehensive sex education. Now, the new funding under the Obama administration is not all that we would want it to be. It's still a little bit narrow in its scope in terms of it's very specifically focused on teen pregnancy prevention. However, it does require that the information be medically accurate, that include information about condoms and contraception as well as abstinence. It's a significant improvement. It's not everything we want, but it's a significant improvement. There was, however, in the healthcare reform law that was passed, a continuation of some of the abstinence-only funds. It was driven through by the Republicans, and it ended up in the final law. So there's still a stream for abstinence-only, while that is now less than the money for comprehensive sex ed. However, now the Republicans are resurgent in Congress, and we expect that there will be attempts to decrease the funding for comprehensive sex education and to increase, once again, the funding for abstinence only. And one of the things that's really important is for Congress people to hear from their constituents that this would be a significant error and a big step backwards, and that it's something that people in the United States do not want for our students. So listeners out there, this is a real opportunity for you to contact your members of Congress and say, we want our funding to go towards medically accurate, comprehensive sex education, and do not bring back abstinence only, because that will play a really important role when decisions are made.
And LaRonda, could you talk to us a little bit about how you see comprehensive sex ed as part of the umbrella of the reproductive justice movement, or how you see that linked to justice issues?
If you can't make choices about your sexuality, you can't make choices. The intrinsic right to make those choices about yourself are just all of what social justice is about. And so I think, you know, Phillida and Gabriella both talked about, you know, law not being enough. It has to be attitudinal shifts. Access or information not being enough. You have to have access to it. And so I see comprehensive sex ed as a huge tool, actually, in the fight for reproductive justice.
This has been National Radio Project's Making Contact. I'm your host, Julieta Kuznir, and we have been very lucky to have in the studio with us today LaRonda Crosby-Johnson with Bay Area Communities for Health Education. We also have in the studio Phillida Burlingame, the Sex Education Policy Director for American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. And we have on the line with us in Los Angeles, Gabriela Valle, the Director of Community Education and Mobilization for California Latinas for Reproductive Justice. Thank you all for joining us.